Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Sitting here reading Rob Prince at Foreign Policy and Focus. He's going to be on the show later. I should have finished this article by now. I'll try to catch up during the breaks. I know the first half of the story, but don't we need an update on the Western war in Mali? I have decided that yes, we do. So that's happening. And then our good friend Sheldon Richmond's going to be on the show to talk about Iran. America's Iran policy. You know, I should write in my notes here to ask Rob about Somalia, too. Because he's great on Somalia. And one of my problems is that hardly anybody's any good on Somalia, you know? But it's such an important story. America's war in Somalia. Try to cover it whenever I can. And Rob Prince, I know he can just go off the top of his head and explain what the hell about that. So, seems to me important for me to ask him. Pardon the dead air, I'm spacing out as I write the date on my notepad. I really wanted to interview Patrick Coburn about his Syria thing. And then I thought, you know what? Maybe I'm starting to bother Patrick Coburn. Having him on too often. Or maybe he's just busy. He always seems happy to do the show, you know. I just don't want to wear it out. I think I'm going to give him a couple of days. But yeah, Patrick, man, he wrote this thing about Syria that, well, we may just talk about. I mentioned it the other day. It's Britain's Syria policy falls apart, something like that. The West's, you might as well have said America's, but he's writing for a British audience. But, yeah, I need a good detailed who's who and who's fighting for what on the ground in Syria. I think David Enders finally got smart and left that place before it was too late for him. Guy was kidnapped by the al-Nusra Front. And then they let him go. Can you believe that? Now, McClatchy's got a guy named Mitchell Prothero writing over there. I don't know much about him, but he's been writing some really good stuff. Of course, one of their reporters, Austin Tice, one of their first reporters into Syria, has been held, presumably, I guess, by the government this whole time. All indications are, at least last I heard, that he's still alive and I don't think he's being held for ransom. He's just being held. It's a dangerous war to be in as a journalist over there in Syria. Past few years there. But anyway, Patrick Coburn, he goes. That guy, he'll go right into a war zone. Well, you know. Hang a jacket up in the window, he says. That way they can't see you too well. Do all right. Hope I didn't just give him away. Anyway, see if I can get Patrick on the show later in the week for you. But we'll probably cover some Syria on the show today anyway. Let me hit refresh on antiwar.com just in case something really important blew up right before I went on the air here that I need to know about. That looks good. So, I want to start, I guess, with some NSA stuff. First of all, I think this got a mention on the show yesterday. No, maybe not. Anyway, I sure would recommend that you go and look at this. It's by Andy Greenberg in Forbes, and he does a lot of really great stuff. Journalism, I mean, about technology issues and stuff. Andy Greenberg over there at Forbes.com. And this one is, an NSA co-worker remembers the real Edward Snowden, a genius among geniuses. And this is credible to me. I saw some people saying, oh, yeah, claims this and that and whatever. But, well, in my opinion, Annie Greenberg has earned the benefit of the doubt as far as his journalism goes. And he says here that all these details he got, he actually checked them with Edward Snowden's lawyer, his ACLU lawyer, to see if he could verify them. And it all checked out. So it seems to me like the person talking to Annie Greenberg here would have to be telling the truth to even know what this person claims to know. Would have to be telling the truth that this person actually does work for the NSA. And I guess I'll just cut to the chase here because, you know, there's a lot of information here. I guess I'll go through it. But I want to go ahead and skip to the end, which is, I was shocked and betrayed when I first learned the news about Ed Snowden talking to Greenwald, leaking the documents. But as more time passes, I'm inclined to believe he really is trying to do the right thing, and it's not out of character for him. I don't agree with his methods, but I understand why he did it, he or she says. I won't call him a hero, but he's sure as hell no traitor. So that is Snowden's former colleague at the, pardon me, keep biting my tongue and breathing incorrectly. Snowden's former colleague at the NSA. Man, I was shocked and betrayed at first, but now I understand. Snowden is sure as hell no traitor. Says his former colleague. And then, so, I think this is interesting. Yeah, you know, it's mostly just kind of factoids. It starts out with he would wear a hoodie from the Electronic Frontier Foundation that has this mock National Security Agency logo on it, but the eagle's got all the wires in his claws. It's the EFF clowning on the official NSA logo, and he would wear this thing to work all the time. And everybody just kind of took it as a joke. It's an ironic kind of a thing. But I guess sort of like that last paragraph implies there, the assumption is they're not doing anything wrong. I mean, they're doing as they're told, and that's right, right? And so there you go. So, yeah, it's a little ironic, but it probably never occurred to most of these people that someone who would wear a sweatshirt that clowns the National Security Agency for violating people's rights would think that that was something for them to do something about rather than just, you know, a funny little comment that they might make. So they just didn't think, I wonder if this Snowden guy would ever give all the truth to Greenwald because apparently he's all hung up on this Bill of Rights thing from back when. Well, he would wear it regularly to stay warm in his facility in Hawaii where he worked. His co-workers just assumed he meant it ironically, it says. A geek as gifted as Snowden could get away with a few irregularities. And just think of how many times they call this guy a dropout. In fact, let's do this right now. Snowden dropout in Google says 301,000 returns. I'm happy to see the first one is fairness and accuracy in reporting, criticizing the rest of the media for it. But boy, if government says, hey, what we're going to do from now on, we're going to call Snowden a dropout, for them to say that, for them to wish it, and for TV people to fall right in line, it's almost the same thing. It's almost not even a two-step process. It's not even a step. The media speaks in the words of the wishes of the state at all times. Call him a dropout. Okay, he's a dropout. Snowden's a dropout. Snowden's a dropout. Oh, whoops. It turns out he was the smartest guy in the whole place. One of them. Months after Snowden leaked tens of thousands of the NSA's most highly classified documents to the media, the foreign intelligence contractor has stayed out of the limelight, rarely granting interviews or sharing personal details. A 60 Minutes episode Sunday night, meanwhile, aired NSA officials' descriptions of Snowden as a malicious hacker who cheated on his NSA entrance exam and whose computers had to be destroyed after his departure for fear he had infected them with malware. Wow, what a dropout this guy is. He's smart enough to cheat on his NSA test. That might well have been the hardest question on the test. Assuming that's even true, which you can bet that it's not, since it's something that they said about him. And then, as Cryptome, I guess John, whatever his name is, was pointing out on Twitter there, if they're saying that they're afraid that he put malware on their computers, then they're giving him credit as that much of a genius that he could put some kind of remote bug on their computers and control them remotely after, you know, leaving and blowing the whistle and going public, that he would still be able to hack in somehow by way of some backdoor that he would create in the NSA's system that they wouldn't necessarily be able to find. They just have to destroy it all to make sure. Sounds like they're calling him a genius to me. The same people who are calling him a dropout. The same people who are saying he's a cheat. Oh, yeah, to cheat on his test. Really? Well, an NSA staffer who contacted Andy Greenberg at Forbes last month and asked not to be identified and whose claims were checked with Snowden himself via his ACLU lawyer offered a very different firsthand portrait of how Snowden was seen by his colleagues in the agency's Hawaii office, a principled and ultra-competent, if somewhat eccentric, employee, and one who earned the access used to pull off his leak by impressing superiors with sheer talent. The anonymous NSA staffer's priority in contacting Andy Greenberg, he writes here, in fact, was to refute stories that have surfaced as the NSA and the media attempt to explain how a contractor was able to obtain and leak the tens of thousands of highly classified documents that have become the biggest public disclosure of NSA secrets in history. According to the source, Snowden didn't dupe co-workers into handing over their passwords, as one report has claimed, nor did he fabricate SSH keys to gain unauthorized access, he or she says. Instead, there's little mystery as to how Snowden gained his access. It was given to him. That kid was a genius among geniuses, says the NSA staffer. NSA is full of smart people. But anybody who sat in a meeting with Ed will tell you he was in a class of his own. I've never seen anything like it. Andy Greenberg writing at Forbes. When I reached out to the NSA's public affairs office, a spokesperson declined to comment, citing the agency's ongoing investigation into the leaks. Over the course of my communications with the NSA staffer, Snowden's former colleague offered details that shed light on both how Snowden was able to obtain the NSA's most secret files, as well as the elusive 30-year-old's character. Now, some bullet points. Before coming to NSA Hawaii, Snowden had impressed NSA officials by developing a backup system that the NSA had widely implemented in its code-breaking operations. He developed a backup system that the NSA said, hey, wowee, and took and implemented for their code breaking. He also frequently reported security vulnerabilities in NSA software. Many of the bugs were never patched. Which, doesn't that remind you of what we already know? Supposedly, you know, what's been reported about his time with the CIA in Switzerland, that he tried going through official channels to get some vulnerabilities fixed and was ignored then. Snowden had been brought to Hawaii as a cybersecurity expert working for Dell's services division, but due to a problem with the contract, was reassigned to become an administrator for the Microsoft intranet management system known as SharePoint. Impressed with his technical abilities, Snowden's managers decided that he was the most qualified candidate to build a new web front end for one of its projects, despite his contractor's status. As his coworker tells it, he was given full administrator privileges with virtually unlimited access to NSA data. Quote, big mistake in hindsight, but if you had a guy who could do things nobody else could do, and the only problem was that his badge was green instead of blue, what would you do? As further evidence that Snowden didn't hijack his colleague's accounts for his leak, the NSA staffer points to an occasion when Snowden was given a manager's password so that he could cover for him while he was on vacation. Even then, investigators found no evidence Snowden had misused that staffer's privileges. And the source says nothing he could have uniquely accessed from that account has showed up in any news reports thus far. His superiors were so impressed with his skills, Snowden was at one point offered a position on the elite team of NSA hackers known as Tailored Access Operations. He unexpectedly turned it down and instead joined Booz Allen to work at the NSA's Threat Operations Center. Another hint of his whistleblower conscience, aside from the telltale hoodie, Snowden kept a copy of the Constitution on his desk to cite when arguing against NSA activities he thought might violate it. The source tells me, that's Andy Greenberg writing at Forbes, Snowden also once nearly lost his job standing up for a coworker who was being disciplined by a superior. He often left small gifts anonymously at colleagues' desks, and he frequently walked NSA's halls carrying a Rubik's Cube, the same object he held to identify himself on a Hong Kong street to the journalist who first met with him to publish his leaks. Snowden's former colleague says that he or she has slowly come to understand Snowden's decision to leak the NSA's files. I was shocked and betrayed when I first learned the news, but as more time passes, I'm inclined to believe he really is trying to do the right thing. It's not out of character for him. I don't agree with his methods, but I understand why he did it, the source says. I won't call him a hero, but he's sure as hell no traitor. So, I thought that was important and worth bringing up. A little bit more about the real Ed Snowden. It sure sounded like, I mean, obviously it is a single source, but it sure sounds like a legitimate source. Talk to Andy Greenberg here at Forbes.com. An NSA coworker remembers the real Edward Snowden, a genius among geniuses. And boy, isn't that counter? Him being the only guy who was able to do the things they needed done. The smartest guy, anyone who was in a meeting with him could tell he was in a class all by himself. In a building full of geniuses. And, didn't they try to say that he, he's a sneak, and he's a cheat, and he's a dropout, and, he's no good, too. And, yeah, what a terrible betrayer of the illegitimate state on behalf of the people and the Constitution that he swore his allegiance to when he went to work for these cretins. I don't know. I wonder, what's the 60-40 on Snowden now? Is it that, it's always funny when Democrats are in power, right? You'll have the conservatives who love the national security state no matter what split from the conservatives who fear it when Democrats are in charge of it. And then on the liberal side, you'll have those who are afraid of the national security state no matter who's in power, versus those who only fear it when Republicans are in power, just the same. But I don't know. I'm kind of feeling the backlash a little bit. I'm kind of thinking, somebody or other was writing in The Guardian last week, that Snowden looks more like a hero now than ever. He's just doing better and better, and all the smears against him have fallen to the side. None of them have held up at all. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. Oh, man, I forgot to change the music to Wednesday's music. This is still Tuesday's music. All right, well, I'll change it right after this song. All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. Hey, man, Amazon.com, if you're buying stuff, go to my site first, scotthorton.org, and look at the top of the right margin there where all the advertisers' links are. The very top one there is Amazon.com, especially if you're like me and you put off all your Christmas shopping and everything to the very end. Just stop by my website and click to Amazon from there, and I'll get a cut from their end. They're not going to charge you more. I'll get a cut from their end of the bargain. A little bit of a kickback if you click like that. So soon we'll have a bookstore and everything there at the new and improved scotthorton.org. Still a work in progress. It's vastly improved, though, if you ask me. I think you'll agree. But yeah, man, so shop Amazon by way of my site and help support the show, too. Sound good? Good. Happy holidays. All right. So, like I said earlier, Rob Prince is going to be in the show and Sheldon Richman, too. And I like this guy, Rob Prince. I've interviewed him a couple of times, and he knows a lot. He's from the, it's not Jewish Voice for Peace, but it's something like that. I'll get it right in a minute. Anyway, he's a good guy. Smart guy. Oh, post article on Snowden. You got it. I will do that. That's right. You can tweet me live during the show, and I will talk back at you. Here you are, Don. There's the title, and control V, and then hit tweet. To tweet, it's now tweeted. Genius among geniuses, the real Ed Snowden. Smartest guy in the room, according to his former colleague at the NSA. All right, so now, in case you didn't hear, it's a really big deal what this federal judge did the other day. Now, what the federal judge did actually was not very much. What the federal judge did was Judge Leon ruled this week that the NSA telephone surveillance going on is probably unconstitutional. But he sort of, he makes his great argument, but he also sort of defers to higher courts and says, well, this is going to be appealed anyway. So here's an injunction. You have to stop that. And then, hang on one second, let me stay my own injunction. You don't have to stop that. But at least on the record, there's an injunction about it. But since I'm so certain you're going to appeal, go ahead and appeal, and I won't stop you from doing what you're doing right now. I'll let the higher courts decide. As Marcy said on the show yesterday, Marcy Wheeler, probably it'll end up at the Supreme Court to decide. But what he said, of course, was absolutely right. And, you know, this goes back to the case we're talking about, Smith versus Maryland, yesterday on the show with Marcy, about the Penn Register. And what this was, this guy robbed this lady, but then he couldn't just leave well enough alone, so he would hassle her all the time, and he would call her all the time and threaten her. You better not tell him what I look like later, or I'm gonna mess you up, blah, 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 something like that. Well, the cops went to the phone company and said, give us the records. And they didn't have a subpoena from a court. They didn't have a warrant or anything like that. They just said, give us the records. And then they used that to prosecute the guy. Well, his lawyers said, hey, you can't do that. You needed a warrant to get those records. His phone records and his dealings with the company, that's all privileged information. And you'd have to have a warrant, so it should be excluded. And the court said, we just made up this thing where if you are in a business agreement with someone and they have your information, none of that information is protected. Huh? Now, it's funny because I hear even stern critics of what the NSA's been doing basically sort of shrugging like that makes perfect sense. And that didn't make any sense at all. In fact, even Rand Paul is good on that. And says, no way, man. Just because I have a deal with the phone company, that doesn't mean that you can go and get whatever my records are with the phone company. Unless this is communism and the phone company is a government agency, then how in the world? In fact, even among government agencies, they're supposed to keep your information, you know, private from each other. Not that they do, but that's supposed to be the rules, right? That the IRS can't just go rummaging through any other information that any other part of the government has about you or something, right? Anyway, this whole case is nonsense. And then here's what the court did that this judge has said you can't do. What the court had previously done, the FISA court, the secret court, had said, well, geez, if the government has the right to get this one guy's records without a warrant, then they've got the right to get everybody's records without a warrant. And if they were allowed to do this one time to this guy on this, you know, violent felony compounded with this harassment thing going on there, then it applies to everyone all the time, whether they're suspected of doing anything or not. Now, how the judge came up with this, well, you know, it's a secret court with no accountability. And the judges, nobody cares. You know, nothing's going to happen to them. And when it's in secret, there's not even the public shame attached to it. So it's just a matter of dotting an I with a smiley face or whatever, right? They just do what they want. They just change it how they want. They say, this word means that word now, if I say so. Oh, collect isn't to collect. It's only to collect if you collect it. But if you don't collect it, then it's only collected and not looked at yet. Huh? And so what this judge said is, that's nonsense. And he said, the expectation of privacy, don't even tell me that, oh yeah, now that the American people have been beaten down into this state of submission, that they don't expect privacy, so they don't have the right to expect it. He said, that's not what counts. If you've been breaking the law all these years and they got used to it, that's not what counts. What counts is, what should they expect from a free society? What do they have the right to demand under the Bill of Rights? And so, never mind what they expect now that the government's got them used to violating their rights all the time. That's beyond the point, beside it. And anyway, Marcy said that it was not the strongest case that the judge could have made in his ruling. And of course, he stayed his own decision that they had to stop in deferring to a higher authority. But what he did do, though, was he, well, as Marcy put it, again, I might as well just defer to her on the whole thing. Any errors are mine. All credit goes to her. He broke the ice. He made it okay for other people involved in government to go ahead and you know, in the judiciary, to agree that, no, the Fourth Amendment bans just this kind of thing. And it takes away that major talking point from the NSA's apologists that all of this is above board, because now it's officially not all justified and sanctified by the courts. So it's just a little something, but it's something. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is the show. ScottHorton.org is the website. You can find all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. ScottHorton.org. We're live 3 to 5 here weekdays at Liberty Express Radio. And our first guest on the show today is Rob Prince from Foreign Policy in Focus and also from Colorado Progressive Jewish News. That's robertjprince.wordpress.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing real good, Scott. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you joining us. It's been too long since we've spoken. You're actually on my whiteboard and no longer erasable ink. It's been on there so long as one of the few people I can call on Africa issues. I refer to your work all the time, in fact.
Thank you.
In regards to the article that you published when the WikiLeaks, Chelsea Manning's liberated WikiLeaks documents revealed the extent to which the Americans had compelled the Ethiopian dictatorship of Meles Zenawi to invade Somalia Christmas 2006. A very important part of the story. We knew it was a joint operation all along with the CIA and the special operations guys and everything, but your article really focused on how the Americans made Ethiopia do it rather than asked very nicely. So anyway, this one is a French remilitarization of Africa under the well-worn pretext of humanitarian intervention. It's in the making here at Foreign Policy and Focus, FPIF.org. And I guess, first of all, can you take us back a little bit to the last couple of years? Because as this article begins, you say it's been, 9 months or almost a year since the French reinvaded Mali. What led to that?
Well, I guess it depends on whether you take the word of the French president, François Hollande, or not. Hollande insists that France's military intervention, that France had nothing to gain from it economically or politically, and it was done only for humanitarian reasons, which is touching.
Too believable, though, really.
And went over very well in France. Having said that, there's reason to believe that, that was just a, how can I put it politely, a bunch of hooey, for a number of reasons. First of all, Mali is a place today where it's not so much that France has major investments there, but it's exploring in the northwest corner of Mali for oil and gas. And then next to Mali, just east of Mali in Niger, France has among its most important uranium mines in the world. They're within less than 100 miles of the Malian border, and that whole region of the Northern Sahara, Central Sahara, is a mineral-rich region whose wealth is being intensively explored. So what happens in Mali is has great strategic importance to the French, particularly within the current context of the, as Michael Ticler refers to it, the race for what's left, i.e. mineral wealth, oil and gas. And France is concerned that it have its place in that race, particularly at a time of growing competition from the Chinese, United States, India, among others. So stabilizing Mali is quite important for strategic reasons to the French. President Holland's comments aside.
Well, and then they have a history going back there. How many centuries? A couple at least.
Well, right? Yeah. You know, France's role in Africa in a kind of serious way starts with the Algerian invasion of 1830 and its conquest of much of West Africa in the 1880s and the 1890s. And colonizing that region was very important. At the time, it was France had a number of goals, and among them was this kind of global competition with Great Britain. In any case, France was forced in the late 1950s and early 1960s to give up its colonies. And what it and de Gaulle, who's kind of a very clever man, he's actually worth studying. He was willing to give formal independence to France's former African colonies, but he charged his main Africa aide, a fellow named Foucault, F-O-C-C-A-R-T, and the idea was that Foucault would engineer some kind of a system in which the former colonies would be formally or politically independent, but would remain economically dependent on France. And that was a very, very successful effort, commonly referred to as neocolonialism. And French neocolonialism in West Africa has been one of the main keys to continued French economic success to the degree that they've been successful. So it's worked. In the case of Mali, the history has been a little bit less clear than in some other places. There were moments in the history of Mali where there was strong nationalist leadership that resisted French economic and political intervention. But eventually, due to a whole number of factors, France was able to regain its stranglehold on the country, and that's been true for some time now.
And then, I guess before we get to the recent conflict, can you talk about, is it just a French-drawn border? Is that why the small, I mean, if you just look at it, you can tell
mm-hmm.
it, the border was drawn by someone with some kind of selfish interest in including people who didn't necessarily fit together in one state?
Well, the drawing of the border... the controversy over the drawing of the borders really takes place in the context of the Algerian revolution of the late 1950s. At that time, France was trying to set up what it referred to, something like a Sahara economic zone, in order to kind of retain control of the resources of that region. So there was a lot of contention over where the borders would be drawn. A lot of the debate, Algeria is just north of Mali, and a lot of the debate over the independence of Algeria had to do with the Sahara, with France wanting to cut the Sahara off from Algeria so it could control it at that point already. They already had oil, and the Algerians insisting that the border move further and further south to include the oil discoveries. The oil was discovered there in 56. The Algerian Revolution began in 54, and there's a number of indications that revolution, that war was so cruel and mean in part because France really refused. It did not want to give up those energy resources, but it was forced to. Eventually, it had to move the border further south. So that was the big argument. The loser in that, I suppose, was Mali at the time. And then what France tried to do was, having lost the political control of that region, it tried to maintain economic control of the Algerian oil industry and the mineral industries in places like Niger and Mali.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So, yeah, it's a whole story. But the fundamental tale here, the fundamental theme here, is France doing whatever it could in whatever way to retain control of the wealth of the region.
All right, and now, so part of that too, though, is the combining of the Tuareg population
right.
of the north, which you know I'm not the expert on this, but I'm under the impression that the northern part of Mali there, northeastern part, is roughly the size of Texas, which I guess would
large.
Make the lower part is sort of the size of the rest of the South, something like that. So of the American South, I meant to say. It's the northerners, as you write about in your article here, the Tuaregs, they've been battling for quite some time.
Yeah.
For at least autonomy, if not outright independence from the South, correct?
Okay, yes. And again, you know, in this area, everything gets a little complex. But they're referred to as the Tuaregs, mostly in French literature. They call themselves Azawad, Azawad, the Azawad people. Mm-hmm. And their living area extends across a number of countries, northern Mali, southern Algeria, a little bit west is Mauritania, a little bit east is Niger, and even into Chad. They're an extension of the Berber people who are kind of the people who lived in that region before the Arabs came. So they've been there for a very, very long time, and they're like the let's say the Kurds or the Palestinians in the Middle East, modern borders basically screwed them, and they have no territory of their own. They're neat people. I mean, these are really the desert dwellers, I've met a few of them years ago, and I really found them fascinating. But having said that. There's been a long-term tension between these people in the north and the black African population in the southern parts of Mali, closer to the Niger River Basin. And these tensions have been there is real discrimination against them, cultural discrimination, economic, social discrimination. There's no question about that. I.e., they have a real case. For their grievances.
And that's just a legacy of the French, then? Is that right? That they just put the South in charge of the North?
Well, if you look at what the French have done throughout French Africa, they take a look at a country that's a colony, and they favor one group over another. In some countries, they favor the Muslim, like Cameroon, for example, they favor the Muslim North over the Christian South. And in the case of Mali, basically what they did was they kind of pitted the North and the South against one another. And in the following way, the French have always had some ties with the Tuareg, with the Azawad, and they have encouraged, either openly or less so, Azawad, Tuareg autonomy, things like that. And that's ultimately what that's about is the French hope that they could use the Tuareg as a vehicle, some kind of Tuareg separatism to control the economic resources of the region. And this even comes out in the recent fighting. For example, there's this Tuareg rebellion, right? Add to it the Islamicists. We can talk about that later. And then the French come in militarily and counter that whole movement. But the ones they go after are the Islamicists. They really have made their peace with the Tuareg rebels. And in fact, the Tuareg rebels come out of this deal with as much autonomy as they've ever had. And so, like in Bamako, in the capital of Mali, they talk conspiracy that there's French Tuareg cooperation. I'm not sure how far it goes, but the history is unquestionable that they played those games. And the other thing that's really clear is France's desire to gain control of that region of northern Mali, a region which they haven't found the resources yet, but there's intensive studies that are going on in the northwest corner of that country. And the real competition there is between who's going to control those resources, the French or the Algerians. So yes, they're being used. The Tuareg appear, on the one hand, they have legitimate grievances, and on the other hand, that's being manipulated. It's an absolutely classic African neocolonial situation of divide and conquer, leading to the kinds of tragic results throughout the continent that we have seen.
All right, so 2011, the Egyptian people, left and right, so to speak, came together, overthrew the American-backed sock puppet dictatorship. So then Hillary Clinton decided she needed a publicity stunt, and Michael Hastings verifies this, my suspicion, in his great work in Rolling Stone, that she needed a publicity stunt because it was too obvious that Uncle Sam was behind every tortured dictator in the region. And so they decided they would betray their new, again, friend, Muammar Gaddafi, in Libya. They would stab him in the back, throw him to the wolves, kind of thing, so they could pretend that America's on the side of the little guy, like that one time when we liberated France from the Nazis back in the black and white footage that everybody's seen. And so that would at least, if it wouldn't prove the case that Uncle Sam's the good guy, it would at least confuse the issue a little bit when it was becoming way too obvious who's wearing the black hat in this situation. So they betrayed Gaddafi, and then his Tuareg goons went back, his hired guns, his mercs, went back to where they're from and brought their guns with them once they lost.
They sure
correct?
Did. Yes, yes. Yeah.
And then what happened?
You got it. That's certainly a part of it. So you have, there are a lot of Malians. Mali, the big problem in Mali is a kind of seething poverty, the likes of which is true in only very, very few countries in the world. That's often, you know, that has to be put forward. Mali is, you know, right down there among the five poorest countries in the world, despite, you know, important gold reserves, in the northern part of the country, in the southern part of the country, there's some agriculture. This is a terribly, terribly, terribly poor country. So they got a lot of folk that leave and look for work elsewhere. In this case, where was the work for a number of decades? It was in the Libyan army. And yes, you have mostly Tuaregs, but some others, Malayan Tuaregs, who form an important part of the Gaddafi's military. So the whole thing collapses in Libya. And I want to come back to France and Libya and make a couple comments about that. And as a result, you have this explosion of unattached people with military training leaving the country, going everywhere, going to Tunisia, going to Chad, Mali. And the Japanese have a term for their samurai who no longer have a master, and they're called Ronin, R-O-N-I-N. And so these are the Libyan Ronin who wind up in northern Mali, armed to the teeth, and also with a lot of military experience. Now, what happens at this point is, from where I'm sitting, it's most unfortunate. So the Azawad, the Tuareg peoples, they have their own political movement and military movement. It's referred to in English as the MNLA. And again, this is the movement really has legitimate grievances, and this is the movement that started the armed struggle. All right, so these elements come from Libya, and these elements are heavily influenced by a number of Islamicist groups. Now, who is pulling the strings on these groups isn't clear exactly, but we know the countries that are involved, and they're the same countries that are funding and arming radical Islamicists everywhere. Qatar, Saudi Arabia, to a certain extent Algeria, the Algerian security apparatus, And so these elements come into northern Mali. Well, the Tuaregs see this as an opportunity to form an alliance with these groups. The alliance is formed, and that gives the military rebellion in the north tremendous force, and it begins to explode. But along the way, something else happens, and that is that the rebellion is hijacked by the Islamists, the kind of Salafist elements, and the Tuareg rebellion itself, which is really essentially secular. Its goals are socioeconomic goals. They're not the implementation of Sharia law. So the whole thing gets transformed. You have a similar situation in Syria where you had a legitimate Syrian opposition. It's hijacked by these similar elements. So that's what happens in Mali. And that provides the pretext, ultimately, for the French-led intervention. So I know it gets a little bit, esoteric here, but that's fundamentally what happened. Now, I want you to think of one thing here. Let's go back to Libya in 2011. What was the pretext? Do you remember the pretext for the NATO decision to move into Libya?
Yeah.
It was
Gaddafi,
Benghazi.
According to Susan Rice, Gaddafi had handed out Viagra to his armies of rapists, and then they were going to go and they were going to murder every man, woman, and child in Benghazi.
That's right. I.e., Benghazi was going to be slaughtered. Later, we found out, I'm sure that if he went into Benghazi, he wouldn't have been, a nice guy. But the notion that the whole city was going to be massacred, this was the pretext. This provided the pretext. The world said, "Oh my God, this is a terrible thing. We have to stop that humanitarian intervention." Bam. In Mali, the situation is not that much different. There was a seizure of a town in Mali. It's called Moti, M-O-H-T-I. And what we heard about Moti is if you seize Moti, that Bamako, the capital of Mali, is next. I.e., they're on the verge of seizing the capital of Mali.
Right, well, because Moti, I'm actually looking at the map here. Moti is south of the line, right? So it seemed like when the Tuaregs had said, we're seceding from the Union, we're declaring independence up here in the north, Hillary was trying to get Algeria to intervene. She's trying to get France to intervene.
Yeah,
Everybody was waiting. But then they blew it. When they teamed up with the Al-Qaeda guys, they went across the line. And like you're saying...
Yeah, they went across the line. Now, if you look at that line is 600 or 700 miles from Bamako. I.e., they're not knocking on the door of Bamako. Bamako is still very, very far away. Secondly, there is something at Moti that no one talks about, and that is a French military base right next to it. Mm. So France was nervous about that. And then finally, what are we talking about from what we can tell about the strength of the rebels? We're talking about a group that at its largest is 5,000 fighters, probably less, and they're going to take a city. Bamako is 1.5 million. And yes, there's a lot of problems with the Malian military, but once again, we have looking at it. Granted, from the Rocky Mountains, it's far away here. But what does it look like? It looks like the threat to Bamako is exaggerated. And once again, we're hearing that Bamako is now the new Benghazi. Oh, if we don't save Bamako. So it's done it's all done in a certain way. The threat is amplified, exaggerated. The world says, "Oh, this is terrible." Meanwhile, while the rebels, the Islamic rebels, were moving into places like Timbuktu and Gao, really the world was doing nothing. And at that time, in fact, the military government, which had seized power in a coup but had popular backing, sanctions were being put on them, so they could not counter this move from the north in any kind of effective.
So they needed the foreign help then, conveniently.
That's right. Yes, and so in any case,
well, the coup was important. It was important too that the excuse for the coup leaders was that the I mean, he was a former military guy, but he'd stood for election a couple of times, some kind of election a couple of times, that they overthrew him because he wasn't doing enough about what was happening in the North. That was their excuse, right?
Well, that was the excuse, but at the same time, sanctions had been put up against him. He was under tremendous pressure to turn his government over, and he did. You know, he turned his government over to a civilian leader who happens to have come from Paris with close ties to NATO. I have his name somewhere, but I can't remember it. But in any case, this particular guy, he's the one who wrote the letter to the United Nations Security Council saying, please come and help us. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, you know, things move very quickly.
All right, now here's the thing about that. The clock's moving pretty quickly, and here in a minute, we're going to have to take a break for a couple of minutes.
Alrighty.
But I hope that you can stay on, because...
I can stay on for what I don't see what time it is. I think I've got a few minutes.
All right. Well, yeah, I'd like to keep you, you know, maybe another 5 or 10, and we could talk
about, all right,
you know, what's happened in the last year since the French invasion.
All right, we'll talk about that too. All right.
As you said, it was a small force of 5,000 guys. They should have been done mopping it up by now. And then also, if you do have a little bit more time, I'd like to ask you about the latest from Somalia, if you can comment on the state of the AU occupation and, you know, American intervention in that poor country.
All righty.
What's going on? All right. Well, and of course, I interrupted you to say all that about a minute early here. But so now I guess I'll just remind everybody, it's the Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Rob Prince from Foreign Policy and Focus. That's FPIF.org. And that's John Pfeffer and the gang over there. And they've got a lot of good guys writing for him over there. And again, Rob was the one who wrote about the WikiLeaks and the invasion of Somalia back in Christmas 2006. A very important footnote for everybody to get their hands on. That's at FPIF.org as well in his archive. And then his own website is robertjprince.wordpress.com. That's Colorado Progressive Jewish News for Rob Prince's blog.
That's me.
And I'm sorry, I know you're a professor at some college or another,
right,
but I don't have it in front of me. Where's that?
I'm a senior lecturer of international studies at the Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver.
There you go.
A dollar gets you on the bus.
Yeah, hey, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, you could get a ride all the way across town. And, I apologize. I'm no good at arithmetic at all. I still got to run out the clock for another 10 seconds. Then the music's going to save me, and I'm going to run and get a Dr. Pepper. We'll be right back, everybody, Rob Prince on the Scott Horton Show right after this. Hang tight right there. Thanks. ScottHorton.org. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, all right. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're in the middle of talking with Rob Prince from the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies, which I should have led with, right? Also, he writes for Foreign Policy and Focus, FPIF.org. And we're talking about this piece in Mali, Conflict Continues, a year after the French-led invasion. So it's part blowback, part exploiting blowback as the excuse for some more intervention and some more blowback. And all the bad guys, they were going to march on the capital city, so they say. And so when was it again? How many months ago was it? Almost a year ago, right, that the French went ahead and occupied the south?
January of this year they went in.
I'm sorry?
January of this year.
Yeah, yeah. So almost the anniversary there. And then, as that's you right. said, it was only 5,000 guys. Maybe they had some Saudi money and some pickup trucks, that kind of thing, some equipment that they may have seized along the way. But then, and of course, they've got an area the size of Texas to run and hide in, I suppose. But then it's all sand dunes, right? So how could the war still be going on now? What's going on now?
Well, you know, it's another case of a kind of a spectacular military operations that don't deal with any of the real issues in the country. So you knew, unless the socioeconomic crisis is addressed, that sooner or later that the social crisis would re-erupt. And rather than waiting for several years now, the crisis re-erupted once again. It re-erupted in the north. And that's where it started in the first place.
And then so now is the southern, is the government based in the south invading the north,
Bamako
fighting the Tuaregs again?
Bamako is in the far south of the country, the capital.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm saying, are they attacking the north now?
Well, the tension, the current tension is between the central government in the south that's trying to exert its will over the north, and the north that wants more autonomy, if not separatism, and so that issue, which has plagued this country since independence in 1960, it just reemerged full force.
And now, according to the government in the south, I guess they have the ultimate talking point now, right? That anyone who resists them is not a nationalist Tuareg rebel, but is an Islamist suicide bomber Al-Qaedaite, right?
Well, yes, that's the card they're trying to play, and of course it plays well outside of Mali, but within Mali, it doesn't really resonate that much. And addressing this issue of the North and the fate of the Tuareg in particular, this is really going to be a central issue. It's been addressed before, and the agreement, there was an agreement in 1992. There were actually several others. In words, it's a good agreement. It's just never been implemented. You know, it promised autonomy. It promised money for infrastructure development, etc. But it just never happened. So we got the same promises this time at the end of the major part of the French military operations. But once again, no meat to it.
And now, so, how many people live in the northern part of Mali?
You know, that's a good question. I think we're talking about. I know it's less than a million people. I think it's somewhere around 500,000.
Wow. And then, so
the country has 12 million people in all. I see different figures from 10.5 to 12 million, with the heaviest concentration in the south of the country, which is a little bit outside of the zone of the Sahara.
And now, what can you tell us about the Joint Special Operations Command at the CIA running around there? Because they got to still be there, right?
Yeah. Well, I've been researching the American role there. And once again, there's a comparison with Libya. and that the French do more of the actual fighting on the ground, but the U.S. is involved quite involved logistically and politically in what's going on. And the United States has been involved militarily in the Sahara for a decade. They have these different initiatives. So the first one was referred to as the Pan-Sahara Initiative, PSI, and then in 2005 it was replaced by what's called the Trans-Sahara Counterintelligence Partnership. And this has involved training of a number of African militaries, including Mali, and some activity on the part of special forces, joint special operation, corps type operations. I've been able to actually uncover two incidents where the special forces were involved. One is in nearby Algeria, where apparently for several years there was an important base at a town in the southern Sahara, the Algerian Sahara, called Tamim Rasset. And there's plenty of evidence of that, and the guy who writes about that in some detail is the British anthropologist Jeremy Keenan. And then in 2009... I just found a reference to special forces operations in northern Mali against the Tuareg, where the Malian government was given, as they call it, logistical support. Of course, you don't really know what that means at this point.
Well, I think even the Americans, weren't the Americans due for a big training exercise with the military of the South? Right before the coup, that they had to call off, or at least officially.
Yes, well, there's an annual operation which is called Operation Flintlock, mm-hmm. and these are very big operations. And there were two of them in 2007 and 2008 that took place in Mali, and they were supposed to take place again this year, but they had to call it off. So U.S. military training, special forces has been there. In fact, if you look at it, one of the failures of U.S. Military policy in Africa has been, it's for the last 10 years, it's the United States that trained the Malian military. And then when the Malian military has to deal with this crisis, it pretty much collapses. So that's not a real,
right. All they're good for is overthrowing the government.
Yeah, and then you mentioned the Scahill film, which by the way is excellent. And one of the things that becomes very clear about the Scahill film is that these special forces are everywhere. They're in Mali and everywhere else, and it's very hard to document their activities. And in many cases, it's not so much that they have actual bases, but they move around. You know, that it's kind of mobile bases, and Toyota trucks or whatever. So at this point, we don't really know the scope of U.S. military intervention in Mali. But it's quite clear on some level that what we're seeing in Mali and elsewhere in Africa is kind of a division of labor between France and the United States. And with the first model being Libya and the second model being Mali, and now watch the third one coming into being in the Central African Republic. So there's some competition between them, and some at the same time cooperation. France has worked very diligently to try to replace Britain as Americans' military junior partner. And in Africa, it appears that it's been for some time now. They've cut a deal, and that's what we're seeing in Mali. So the exact framework of it is unclear, but the broader outlines of it.
Didn't they build a drone base in Niger?
Excuse me?
Wasn't there something about a drone base being put in Niger?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. Yes, that from what we know, there's a drone. Yes, there's a drone base in Niger. There's also the reinforcement of the French military presence in Niger.
Well, all they need, too, is rumor that, hey, you know, I heard that somewhere a member of Boko Haram shook hands with one of these Tuaregs that once knew a Libyan jihadist who'd been to Iraq or whatever. And now all of a sudden you spread the war down to, you know, you internationalize a local problem really quickly.
Well, that's well put, because that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing the internationalization of what is a local or the most regional problem that should be addressed by the players in the region. But because of the race for resources, it's become internationalized to a very, very great degree. So in this part, in Mali, it's really the French that are, if you like, the more aggressive component with American backing, and then in Somalia, if you like, it's the other way around. You know, America takes the lead. So yes, we see this, and all this has been going on really for a decade. So Mali is just the latest area of tension and confrontation, to a degree that's of course very cruel and unnecessary. Mm-hmm.
And now, for some reason, I'm completely spacing out on who it was that I read and interviewed about Somalia recently, who talked all about how, when the Kenyans kicked the al-Shabaab militia out of Kismayo, that really solidified their turn toward being an international movement more allied with Zawahiri's goals than focusing on their local things, and if only because they need the revenue. They need Saudi donors. And so, since they don't have the port to sell their charcoal anymore, and so that just took, you know, the problem that, as we've covered before, they had created in Somalia in the first place with al-Shabaab and turned them toward the internationalization. That was only a couple of months ago. My apologies to whoever's name I'm not thinking of.
No, well, we're looking at Somalia and Mali of really two failures in any kind of what we might call conflict resolution. And indeed, these conflicts are going to fester for a long time, and they provide the pretext long-term for further U.S., French, whatever, militarization of the region, whether it's East Africa or West Africa. I don't see an end to this instability for some time. It's a real shame. Scott, I'm going to have to leave you.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your time.
And I appreciate your call and hope it wasn't too confusing. It gets into some pretty esoteric stuff, but...
Oh, no, it's a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
All right, you take care.
All right,
we'll do it again sometime. Bye.
Bye. Yeah, see, my problem is I was trying to make it to the break. Almost made it to the break. But I blew both of those on that interview. But still, that's a good one, right? All right. So that's okay. Music's going to play in a minute. In the meantime, I will refer you back to FPIF, Foreign Policy in Focus. In Mali, conflict continues a year after the French-led invasion, by Rob Prince. And you can find that all-important article that he wrote about the WikiLeaks in Somalia and how they proved that George Bush, I guess Condoleezza Rice, had twisted Melissa Nawi's arm and the dictator of Ethiopia and basically coerced him into invading Somalia in Christmas 2006 and destroying that place ever since. Let's see here. I got serious stuff I'm going to hold. Oh, I know what I can talk about real quickly. Cotter reveals why he pleaded guilty. I was left with a hopeless choice. You know, it almost took place that I wasn't going to get a chance to talk about this on the show. I'm glad I've got a chance to talk about it. This is from the globeandmail.com. Former Guantanamo Bay prisoner Omar Cotter has explained for the first time why he pleaded guilty to five war crimes
saying it was because he had been, quote, left with a hopeless choice. In a new court filing obtained by the Canadian press, Cotter says he knew the Americans could have held him indefinitely, even in the highly unlikely case that he was acquitted. I was left with a hopeless choice. Yeah. If I wanted the chance to eventually return to my home of Canada, I would have to have been found guilty of crimes as determined by the U.S. government, which could then lead me to serve my sentence in Canada. In the affidavit filed in federal court, et cetera, et cetera. So in any case, all he's trying to say in English there is that it was his only chance of ever going home was to lie and tell the Americans what they wanted to hear, that he was guilty of anything, so then the Canadian government could take him back, and then he would have at least some kind of chance of ever being set free. You got to figure it's still probably better being a prisoner in Canada than at Guantanamo Bay. But anyway, he was only 15 when the Americans kidnapped him and tortured him and threatened to rape and kill his mother and beat the living hell out of him and held him at the Bagram prison. Back in the old days, Bagram prison. You can watch a documentary all about Cotter called You Don't Like the Truth or You Don't Want the Truth, which is a quote from him to his interrogator, who knows that he's telling the truth. It's just like an actor on a stage going through the motions of pretending he doesn't believe this kid. It's ridiculous. But then they also interview, well, the guy says he has monster tattooed across his chest and that he earned that. It wasn't some ironic thing. He was the meanest guy on the cell block at Bagram, but he protected this kid because he was just a kid. But when he wasn't around, he got the worst of Bush torture.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. So I found the video of the Cotter movie, You Don't Like the Truth. And then get this, when I click on the YouTube to play, it says, we're sorry, the video you're trying to watch cannot be viewed from your current geographic location due to rights restrictions. Are you kidding me? I was going to queue up the part about Monster admitting how he and the boys had tortured the kid, or how he was the only one who didn't. And anyway, Omar Cotter, he was accused of the war crime of fighting in a battle, of being a civilian fighting against an invading military force, and of killing a soldier on the other side. They call him a medic, but he wasn't fighting as a medic. He was fighting as a soldier at the time, just happened to be a medic too. It was a Delta Force raid, and the kid was 15, and he was there because his father dropped him off with these guys and said, stick with these guys and do what they tell you. He was 15 years old. And then he was shot and wounded, I think shot twice, and pretty badly wounded. They found him under a pile of rubble, almost dead. And then they made up this whole story. And obviously it was the interrogators who made up the story, not the kid, that he had been sitting there hiding behind the wall, and then pulled the pin and threw the grenade back up over his head like he would have seen on TV or something like that. And then this grenade killed this Delta Force soldier. And the whole thing was completely implausible. And all the evidence was that he was already shot and laying in a debris field by the time that this sergeant was killed. And then problem for him was he was the only person who survived on the bad guy's side, and so they decided that there was going to be hell to pay, and he was going to pay it. That's it. So they tortured him, and they beat him, and they threatened his family, and they made him pretend that any of this crap was true, and everybody knew it was a lie, and then they sent him to Guantanamo Bay, and they tortured him there too, and held him forever and ever. So that was his plea deal, was we'll stop torturing you if you just go ahead and lie and pretend like you did it. Fine. And meanwhile, being a civilian and shooting a soldier who's invading the place where you are, that's not a war crime, even if he did do it. Nobody thinks it's a war crime. Only stupid liars and politicians and people like that. It's not a war crime, under any actual legal definition of a war crime. The war crime is what they did to Khadr, to Omar Khadr, 15 years old. And anyway, he's still in prison in the maximum security, whatever. And what was the sentence that they finally put him to? Doesn't say. Anyway, he's still in prison, this kid. And just because of lies. It's amazing how they get away with this kind of stuff, right? You'd think that there'd be a movement somewhere, you know, lawyers for Khadr. We all refuse to prosecute one more defendant until this kid is set free, they all shouted. Isn't that funny? Can you imagine? All the prosecutors refusing to prosecute anymore until these hopelessly, helplessly innocent people who were prosecuted. Prosecutedly people who didn't do it. Until they're set free, we won't go along anymore. See them all picketing in the streets and stuff like that? Yeah, maybe. Anyway, you know what? I tried to see if it was on the Pirate Bay, and they didn't even have it at the Pirate Bay. You don't like the truth. Well, maybe in your geographic location, you'll be able to find it. Looks like maybe they have it in pieces on YouTube somewhere. 4 days inside Guantanamo. You don't like the truth. 4 days inside Guantanamo. All right, and then, I'll save you the rant. I'll just read you the headline. Afghan military cedes checkpoints to Taliban in Helmand province. Okay. Six soldiers killed by Taliban in Afghan copter crash, or at least Taliban claimed it. And, Syria. Well, I think maybe I'll talk a little bit about this with Sheldon. And that is what we talked about with Jacob Hornberger the other day. And with Dan McAdams, for that matter. Is it possible the West is changing their minds about what to do in Syria? West tells Syria rebels, Assad must stay. You're going to have to get used to it. You're going to have to come to the talks and work it out. Assad is staying. And then, on the other hand, from foreign policy, the U.S. is weighing closer ties with the hardline Islamists. You know, giving all these weapons to the Free Syrian Army, which turns around and gives them all to the Islamists this whole time, that's been great and everything. And it's helped them become the unlimited, super-duper, extra majority? They already were the super majority of the entire resistance in the war the whole time, and everybody who ever listened to this show knew that. But anyway, now they're saying, okay, you know what? Even if you've outright sworn allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri, maybe we'll go ahead and fund you anyway. Boy, playing good cop and bad cop all at the same time. Here, this one's from the GulfNews.com. U.S. mulls, I like mulls in this case. U.S. mulls aiding Islamist groups. Okay, this whole time, the American CIA has been coordinating the Turks, the Saudis, the Qataris, and their backing of all of these rebels, who the whole time it's been the harder line Islamists leading the thing, because the harder line you are, the harder you fight. That's the rule. And it's a giant Sunni insurgency, and it's led by Zarqawiites. And from Iraq and from all over the region. This is all George Bush's fault. I mean, and Obama's. But man, you really should not have done that Iraq war thing, dude. Tried to tell you. Now, U.S. mulls going ahead and outright backing the Islamic Front, Jabhat al-Nusra, ISIL Brigade. And at the same time, they're saying, geez, maybe we ought to keep Assad.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of the Future Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for the Future Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's the Future Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me, you heard it here. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott. It's the show. Next up is our friend Sheldon Richmond, Vice President of the Future of Freedom Foundation and editor of their journal, The Future of Freedom, which makes him editor of me from time to time. Welcome back. How are you doing, Sheldon?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us today. You got this article at fff.org. Does Obama want an agreement with Iran or not? And so my first question to you on the show today, sir, is does Obama want an agreement with Iran or not?
Well, I asked you first.
I don't know. I keep wondering that myself. What is this guy doing?
Well, that's what I asked in the article. I laid out the conflicting signals we get. And then I leave it up to the reader to decide, because I sure don't know. We get an interim agreement, which he brags about and seems to defend, under which the Iranians are bending over backwards to demonstrate to the world that they're not building a nuclear bomb. Of course, that just confirms what American and Israeli intelligence have been saying for years. But they're willing to, you know, go that extra mile to demonstrate it by allowing daily intrusive inspections and by rendering their stockpile of 20% uranium-enriched uranium into a form that can't be used to build bombs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in return, getting, you know, the most modest relief, it hardly even deserves to be called relief, from the sanctions. And then on the other hand, Obama... So then he tells the Senate, cool it with new sanctions, because McCain and those guys have been talking about it. So that seemed like a good sign, telling the Senate to shut up. But then on the other hand, he goes to the Brookings Institution, the Sabin Center, the Saban Center, same place where Netanyahu appeared, and before a very pro-Israeli audience tells him, well, I think there's only a 50-50 chance that the interim agreement will lead to a permanent comprehensive agreement. Well, that seems sort of pessimistic, given what he's done. And then... You know, just before telling the Senate to cool it on sanctions, he himself imposed sanctions on about a dozen companies that do business with Iran. So it's while it's indirect, it's not directly on Iran, it's on companies that do business with Iran. And that nearly blew up the whole negotiation because the foreign minister, he left at one point. Luckily, he said, okay, we'll keep going. But this can't be a good development. So does Obama know what he wants?
Right. Yeah, it's really something else. I mean,
first of all, one thing that you left out there was before the Saban Center speech, which I have another possible spin on that. But before that, I mean, he was facing some real heat from the Israelis, from Benjamin Netanyahu, is just denouncing the thing up and down, and you know, sending his people here to get the Senate, you know, I mean, outright lobbying the Senate to oppose the president. And so Obama and Kerry had to, you know, be pretty, you know, tough that out anyway to get through that, face that down. And then again, like you're saying, that's just one more reason why it's such a buildup to then be kind of for nothing, it sounds like.
Yeah, what I point out in the article is to tie in with what you're now saying, the Obama administration is in continuous consultation with Israeli officials.
Right.
They're not a party. They're not part of the P5 plus one. Okay, that's the Security Council in Germany, the permanent members of the Security Council in Germany. Israel is no part of that. And yet, they might as well be, the way things are going. They're being continuously consulted with Susan Rice, who was doing this. Kerry has done it. Obama himself has done it. And so it's enough to make you very suspicious that they're putting on a charade. For us. Now, France, I see a headline in the Wall Street Journal, breaking news, that France is now saying, well, we don't think this is ever going to lead to a permanent thing. They say that Iran, and we don't really think Iran's ever going to really want to give up its the nuclear stuff. So France, which has, of course, pending contracts with both Saudi Arabia and Israel, defense-related, military-related contracts, has never been enthusiastic about this. And I don't like the handwriting I'm seeing on the wall.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, that's part of the danger of having the two-step process is if you get the one step, you just make it easy to, you know, break the ice and get something signed. That makes sense. But, man, now you got 6 months for the bad guys to rally their forces against any final deal. And if they're able to, as you're implying there, you know, successfully define the final deal has to mean no centrifuges spinning at all, no nuclear material anywhere, well then, no, they're not going to get that. That's exactly what they're not going to get, and they're deliberately sabotaging it in the first place if that's what the French are going to try to insist on, as you said, on behalf of the Israelis.
Yeah, look, we know that they're not going to prostrate themselves to the U.S. Given the history, you know, no state would want to do that, but given the history of the Iran-American relations, going back to 1953, of course they're not going to do that. That would only embolden the hardliners, and hurt the reasonable guys like Rouhani and his foreign minister. And is that what Obama's trying to promote here? I mean, it makes me very suspicious that he doesn't want this to work out. He wants it to look like he did his best, but he's more catering to Israel and Israel supporters, which are, you know, which are very powerful, of course.
Well, and then the thing about the sanctions, too. Well, I was going to say one spin on the Saban Center thing that I saw may have been MJ Rosenberg saying that, you know, the fact that he has to go to the Saban Center and allay their concerns, in a way, I mean, you're right, he did, you know, that whole 50-50 thing sounds pretty throwing cold water on the idea and all of that, in a way. But at the same time, who else does he have to go convince about this other than those who put the interests of a foreign country first? There are no other interest groups opposed to this deal but them. And so, in a way, he's sort of calling them out just by having to go there and say, listen, everybody, it's going to be all right, you know? But I don't know. I mean, maybe it's a little bit of both there.
Unless it's part of a show. I mean, look, I don't know. I don't have sources inside the administration. I'd be very interested to hear what some of your Iran experts will be saying about this. I hope someone has a more positive spin about it. But I find it hard to put a positive spin on it. I do. You know, when you see the remarks from David Cohen, who's the sanctions czar at the Treasury Department, you know, when they impose this. These new restrictions on the trading partners. You know, he said, "Look, Iran is off limits. We did this to show you that even though we're doing negotiations, we are committed to a severe sanctions regime." Come on, that's they're talking out of two sides of their mouth.
Right. Well, you know, when Obama put those new sanctions on,
I guess, you know, convinced the Senate not to pass new ones, but then went ahead and implemented tighter restrictions under the existing sanctions, which is sort of the same thing. Violated the spirit of the deal, as the Russians put it. I think it was kind of, you know, pretty, we got lucky so far, I guess. I mean, to say that the politics in Iran are such, it's sort of, I guess, Rouhani's honeymoon, first 100 days kind of thing going on over there for a little while longer, maybe. But the fact that they, you know, temporarily broke off the lower level technical talks on the implementation of the first part of the deal for a few days there is an indication that they might not be able to, you know, be the bigger man and ignore it and press on with the negotiations, regardless if the Americans or the and or the French, you know, come up with another couple of these and try to screw up the deal. At some point, they're going to have too much heat attacking them from their right back at home, you know, about how much face they're losing, because, of course, that's what counts so much to these guys.
Yeah, I'm ominously reminded of what happened in the 90s when the U.S. and the U.N. were conducting inspections in Iraq, and the Clinton administration made it clear that the sanctions won't be lifted merely by a demonstration that Iraq doesn't have weapons of mass destruction. In other words, it's only regime change that will lead to the end of sanctions. And Saddam heard that loud and clear, which made, I think, you know, the invasion by Bush later on, not too many years later, you know, more or less inevitable. I mean, once you tell some people, now I'm not putting Rouhani in Saddam's category. Saddam was a ruthless dictator. But once you tell people, look, it doesn't matter what you're going to do, what you do, the sanctions are remaining or are going to get worse, what do you think is going to happen? That doesn't engender cooperation.
Right. And, you know, here's the thing, too. It's funny. I saw Stephen Walt pointing out the irony that all the people that think that Iran's nuclear program is not a big deal think that this deal is a really big deal. It's just because we're so desperate to have this fake, stupid issue finally put to bed. And, you know, I mean, I guess for me, it's, you know, without the nuclear issue, then all they can cry about is, you know, Hamas and Hezbollah and whatever, which doesn't amount to much. It's, you know, the N-word, right. Nuclear, scary, mushroom cloud and all that shuts down all discussion and you know, makes it possible for people to really scaremonger us into fresh conflicts, or at least out of peaceful resolutions to outstanding issues and whatever else. So
I agree. And I have no doubt that Netanyahu knows that full well. He'd much rather have Iran looking like a menace with possible nuclear weapons than have the world concentrate on Hamas, namely Gaza, and Hezbollah, namely Lebanon. The reason there's Hezbollah is because of repeated invasions and occupation of southern Lebanon by Israel. The reason there's Hamas, well, for one thing, Israel helped to encourage the growth of Hamas as a way of taking away support from the secular PLO. So they created this mortal danger. And they don't want concentration on how the people, you know, they don't want the world concentrating on how the Palestinians in Gaza are being treated, much less the West Bank and inside Israel itself.
Yeah, and of course, they could hardly portray Hezbollah as any kind of threat at all if they didn't just, you know, equate Hezbollah with the government of Syria and the government of Iran and you know, pretend that it's just a projection of Tehran's power and all that kind of thing, which isn't really true. But
no, it's ridiculous. First of all, no, they have their own local issues. The government of Lebanon, you know, going back to the 80s, could do nothing for the people in southern Lebanon and protect them from the Israelis. The Israelis violate their airspace all the time. People live there with sonic booms going off all the time because of Israeli jets. They don't know what's going to happen next. Hezbollah arose to protect people in southern Lebanon, to also provide various kinds of social services. Hezbollah is in the government. It's a party, basically. So to just condemn it, I'm not saying it never, you know, committed any kind of violence that should be condemned, but to just portray them as, quote, a terrorist organization is propaganda, just propaganda coming from Israel and the Israel supporters in the United States.
Yeah, and that much less believable if we're friends with Iran again.
That's right.
Without
there was an analysis, and I forget who wrote this, but there was a very good analysis that I think, summed up the Israeli, or at least certainly Netanyahu's attitude. He wants two kinds of countries in the Middle East. I mean, not counting Israel. He either wants Saudi Arabia type countries, which are totally, you know, beholden to the United States and pretty much rely on the U.S. And countries that are beyond the pale, like Iran has been. You know, the U.S. can't even talk to or touch. And his real fear is Iran will become a non-aligned but friendly country with the United States. Just friendly because of trade and tourism and exchanges, but not a client of the U.S. He wants two kinds, like I said, pariahs and clients, U.S. clients,
right.
Which means effectively an Israeli client. And they're afraid that Iran will break that mold and stick out its own position.
Right. That reminds me of when John McCain said, hey, you know, Hamas won the election of 2006. They're the government of the Gaza Strip now, so you got to talk to them. And then somebody notified him that he wasn't supposed to say that, and he had to take it back real bad.
Hamas has done some things which also should be condemned. But if you stack up the victims of Hamas versus the Palestinian victims of Israel, there's no contest. And it's very rarely pointed out, or almost never, that when Hamas fires rockets, which, again, I don't defend, but when it fires rockets at villages, those were villages that were once inhabited by Palestinians, going back to pre-48, who were people who were driven out of those villages and herded into Gaza. So that gives a little context that we shouldn't forget.
Yeah, meanwhile, they have drones and F-16s bombing them whenever they feel like it all the time. And the Israelis always call attack defense, but that doesn't make it so.
Right.
But
right. No.
But yeah,
no,
I mean, in fact, you know, before Hamas, the reason there was an election in 06 is because the Republicans agreed with, I guess, Sharon then, and in 05, that we got to hold elections because the Israelis can't be expected to negotiate with Arafat when he's not democratically elected. He has no legitimacy whatsoever, so he has to stand for election first. And then he lost the election. And then, even then, they had to form a coalition government with Fatah, Hamas did, in the Gaza Strip, which they just canceled the results in the West Bank. But in the Gaza Strip, they had to form a coalition government, but then Elliot Abrams and Hosni Mubarak went and smuggled them a bunch of weapons, Fatah, to try to beat Hamas, but Hamas just got the guns and beat them and kicked them out, and so it's ruled the Strip ever since and under the terrible siege ever since. But that's where it all came from, was you're beyond the pale. We don't have to deal with you.
Exactly. That's right.
In the first place.
Even though, you know, Hamas leaders have distanced themselves from their original charter, and there have been conciliatory statements over the years, but then what happens? A Hamas leader gets assassinated by the Israelis. You know, usually around the time, like a day after they've made some conciliatory statement, because, oh, we can't have a Hamas leader saying anything conciliatory. We got to get rid of that guy. They want the extremists. It's funny that the hardliners on both sides have a common interest.
Right.
If you look at Iran or Hamas or Hezbollah, the hardest liners, you know, the, and I don't even like that word, but the people that are against any kind of rapprochement on both sides, I think, know they have a common interest in bolstering each other.
Well, now, so back to this president guy that we're stuck with here, the Obama is his name, I think.
Peace Prize winner. He won a Peace Prize.
Yeah, something or other like that. So he's got this thing. Okay, so the old policy seemed to be, you know, the Cheney policy would have been, we try to negotiate with these guys, and they're, you know, suicidal and crazy and religious, and we can't deal with them, and so we have to bomb them. That's the only option we've got left. Now, it hadn't seemed to me that, that Obama was really trying to negotiate a permanent solution to this thing. You look at him deliberately flubbing it in 09 and 010 and then just adding more sanctions since then and all of that. But at the same time, it seemed to me like he was just trying to run out the clock. He wasn't necessarily trying to build up that excuse that, hey, we tried to deal with them, so now we're going to have to go ahead and bomb them. But then again, he kind of keeps saying that, right? That this is the path to war. If the Republicans pass more sanctions and screw up these negotiations, that these negotiations are the only thing between us and war now. So maybe he does mean, what do you think? Do you think that this is really just still the Cheney policy of we've got to, you know, check off all the boxes on the list so we can pretend that we tried everything and had to resort to force?
Yeah, they got a little bit, I don't know, maybe they don't really know what they're doing. I mean, we always assume they kind of know what they're doing. There's some grand strategy. But why the, you know, why these sanctions on the dozen companies? Doesn't that just tip their hand? How can they say we've really tried everything when someone can say, well, wait a second, you got an interim agreement which you praised. Everyone's saying, look, cooperate it. And the first thing you do is impose sanctions, intensify the sanctions. So I don't, maybe they don't know what they're doing. I mean, maybe they're just totally incompetent. I used to think Obama was probably a pretty bright guy. In recent years, I've come to doubt that very seriously. I mean, he can be wrong and bright, but I think he's wrong and not so bright.
Yeah, I mean, they're just Democrats. I don't expect that much of them, really, even if they mean well, you know?
All right. Well, I think we're getting the worst. I don't think they're very bright, and they don't mean well.
So let me ask you this, then. We talked about the situation in Palestine there a bit. Have you seen Jesse Raimondo's article about the boycott and divestment movement?
Well, thanks to you, I became aware of it, and so I only read the first couple of paragraphs. I see where he's going. I'm very eager to read Max Blumenthal's book, which I have not read yet. I have it, and I've looked at the first chapter, but I have to read it. So say more about it.
Yeah, it's a hell of a thing. I keep getting distracted. I need to finish that thing. I'm about a third of the way through it or something like that. It's a nightmare, though. And honestly, you know what it is? It's dissuading me. It's too much information, you know? This is something that Raimondo refers to in his article that, you know, just keeping track of the interrelationships of the different countries themselves is a big enough chore without, like, having to get that far into the inner workings of somebody else's entire society where I've never even been there or whatever like this. But and it's all so horrible that it's really, you know, it's a bummer, man, reading that book. It's worth it. It's worth the education. Yeah. I'd recommend it to anyone, and I really need to get it finished and interview Max all about it because I already got a ton of questions I want to ask him. But it's really bad, you know? It's like... I guess the closest approximation that, you know, that I'm familiar with would be the Jim Crow South from just the generation before me, you know?
So he's focusing, I take it, both on Israel inside the Green Line and the, I don't like to call them the occupied territories, I think even that demotes them, the rest of occupied Palestine.
Well, you know, I'm actually not that far. So far, it's all still within Israel proper, although I do know that he spent a lot of time in Ramallah at some point. In fact, I guess there's some parts where he's talking about being in Ramallah. Am I right about that? Or maybe I'm just thinking of other things he's written. Anyway, I don't think I know the answer to that so far, Sheldon.
Okay. Actually. Well, I look forward to it. I mean,
But there's a lot of history. You know, already I read about... you know, Cass Led and the Mavi Marmara and a lot of, you know, the history of Jaffa and the history of, you know, some of the different stuff that took place during the Nakba and the different villages and whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's an interesting book. It's an interesting book.
Sure.
It'll be the most I know about Israel, which will make a lot of people mad, I guess.
Well, the problem is not enough people are going to read it, and people who need to read it won't read it. And, you know, look, I saw a discussion on Facebook.
It's in its second printing now.
Well, that's a good sign.
You know,
it's just so easy. I saw a discussion on Facebook just the other day where people who were condemning the people who were promoting the boycott of Israel. And, you know, their criticism you can make of a general boycott. Justin, I know, discussed that in his beginning of his article. But that aside... the people at in this Facebook thread were saying the only possible reason for there being a boycott of Israel over the Palestinians, when there's so much other, so much worse human rights abuses going on in the world, there could only be one thing: anti-Semitism, and anti-capitalism, as if Israel had a free market, which it doesn't. They couldn't think of any other reason for people being mad at Israel except for racism, you know, anti-Semitism. And being against the free market. It's ridiculous. You know, do they really believe that? It's absurd. There's lots of other reasons.
Yeah, well,
those are not the main reasons.
I think a lot of them really do believe that because it's a lot less trouble than having to think much further about it. But you know, as Justin puts it in his article, well, what other place in the world actually has this kind of law of the land where you have to be this ethnicity to have a house, or you have to be this ethnicity to be able to do this or that or the other thing, never mind the occupied territories, you know?
That's right, and here's a telling thing, and it's an old story, but most people don't know about it. There's no such thing as Israeli nationality, right? If you're a citizen of Israel, that doesn't make you an Israeli national. Under nationality, it says Jew or Arab or perhaps other. There are other categories. But so a Jewish citizen of Israel, that person's nationality is Jew. And an Arab citizen of Israel, the Israelites talk about how, oh, no, our Palestinian citizens have the right to vote and blah, blah, blah. But they're not even listed as Israeli nationals. They're listed as Arab under nationality.
And it is just plain old white supremacy colonialism. And I know that makes everybody mad to call some Jews white supremacists, but, I mean, really, they're Europeans, and they are, you know, refugees. They're not, you know, an imperial power, you know, a colony of an imperial power. They're their own colony or whatever.
No, that's right. I agree with Gilad Otzman on this. It's not right to call it, to use the language colonialism, because there's no mother country, like you just said. There's no mother country. It's not classic colonialism. It's simply aggression and occupation. And it's not really apartheid, although it takes the form of apartheid. But the difference with, say, South African apartheid was the South African whites, or the Afrikaners, wanted to exploit the black majority. The Israelis don't want to exploit the Palestinians. They want them out. They just haven't figured out a way to do it yet that will minimize the flak. Mm-hmm. They don't want to keep them there to do the dirty, the grunt work, the menial work. They want them gone. That's different from apartheid.
Yeah. Although, the racism, it's funny. I think because Jews typically in history are an oppressed minority of their own, and people are so hesitant to look at it as a white supremacy, Ashkenazi over darker skinned people kind of an issue. It seems to me it really obscures the fact that that's really a lot of what's going on here. If you just put the shoe on the other foot and it was the Arabs doing any of these things to quote unquote the Jews, it would be the biggest deal in the whole wide world. Bulldozers coming and tearing down their homes and saying, oh, yeah, no, because you're a Jew, we get to bulldoze your home and build our home there instead. It would be the biggest deal in the whole world. But then when Jews do it to Arabs, what are you going to do? That's how it is.
Look, they're kicking out 40,000 Bedouins. Luckily, that got shelved. But when that was a live option, and still may come back, the Prawer plan, I saw lots of comments about it. That's no big deal. That's no big deal. So what? Well, so what? Yeah. And like people say, look, Jordan is the real Palestinian country, so what's wrong with picking up the Palestinians and dropping them in Jordan? Well, that's a little like saying, let's pick up New Yorkers and drop them in New Jersey. Same kind of people.
Yeah, or taking all of the Jews in Israel and putting them in Germany. Or somewhere in Eastern Europe where their families.
Well, Israelis are moving to Germany freely.
Yeah. Oh, we talked about that on the show before as well. Because who wants to live in a fascist dictatorship? All right. Thanks, Sheldon. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Scott.
Always good to talk to you. That's Sheldon Richman, everybody. FFF.org. He's vice president there. Future Freedom Foundation. See you tomorrow.